This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. As the sound of gunfire echoed in Sudan's capital for a fourth night, residents are trying to survive amid a lack of essential services and supplies. Reuters correspondent Trevor Coral has more.
The sound of explosions, the sight of low-flying fighter jets. This is what it's been like for Sudan's residents since fighting broke out between warring factions on Saturday. It's become a situation described by the UN as a humanitarian catastrophe. On Tuesday, a planned 24-hour ceasefire came into effect. It was shattered shortly after the deadline. The sounds of fighting echoing again into the night.
Now, the Sudan conflict has prompted many global calls for a ceasefire, but questions still remain about how two other countries can persuade combatants in Khartoum to lay down their arms. U.S. officials in Congress and the White House say they're using their status in Washington and limited leverage to try to make peace. Anita Powell reports for VOA.
The White House says it is working hard to bring about peace, but declined to say what the consequences would be if the warring parties didn't listen. Karine Jean-Pierre, White House Press Secretary.
We've been very clear about the importance of de-escalating, and you've heard Secretary Blinken speak to this. You heard my colleague from NSC speak to this as well. And so I'm just not going to go beyond to what they have said.
U.S. lawmakers familiar with the continent say the stakes are high. Washington's ties with Khartoum have long been strained, and the U.S. suspended assistance to Sudan during the 2021 coup.
That's VOA's Anita Powell. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited the Kremlin's forces fighting in Ukraine for a second time in 2 months. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, meanwhile, made his latest trip near the front line on Tuesday. This is VOA News. Four Americans affiliated with Black Empowerment and political organizations have been charged, along with three Russians, with conspiring to covertly sow discord in U.S. society, spreading Russian propaganda and interfering in U.S. elections. An indictment unsealed Tuesday adds the new defendants to an existing case in Tampa, Florida federal court involving Alexander Ionov, described by prosecutors as the founder of a Moscow-based organization funded by the Russian government to carry out an influence campaign in the U.S. The four Americans, all part of the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru movement, which has locations in St. Petersburg, Florida, and St. Louis. China revealed new details of sanctions it previously announced against two U.S. weapons manufacturers, including a ban on Chinese companies doing business with them. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma with more.
China imposed trade and investment sanctions in February on Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Technologies Corporation's Raytheon Missiles and Defense for supplying weapons to Taiwan, the self-governed island claimed by China. China's Ministry of Commerce says in a statement the sanctions include a ban on exports and imports by the two companies from and to China, it says, to prevent Chinese products from being used in their military business. It's not clear what immediate impact the penalties might have, but the restrictions on imports and exports could hurt the two companies. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The White House says it is working hard to bring about peace, but declined to
say
what the consequences.
The Missouri man charged with shooting a black teen who mistakenly rang the man's doorbell has surrendered. I'm Norman Hall. Authorities in Kansas City say the 84-year-old man charged in last week's shooting of a black teen has surrendered. The sheriff's office says Andrew Lester turned himself in a day after being charged with first-degree assault and armed criminal action. Some civil rights leaders urged a hate crime charge, but the county's top prosecutor says the assault charge carries a longer sentence, up to life in prison. Police say that 16-year-old Ralph Jarl's parents asked him to pick up his twin brothers at a home. Jarl, an honor student, rang the doorbell at the wrong address and was shot by Lester in the forehead, then shot again in the right forearm. He's recovering. I'm Norman Hall.
Chinese state media say that a fire killed at least 21 people at a hospital in Beijing and forced dozens of people to evacuate. Reports say at least 71 patients were rescued Tuesday after the fire broke out. Video circulating on social media showed people escaping out of the windows. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Wednesday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine blames the delayed arrival of Western weapons for a pause in its counteroffensive plans.
President Volodymyr Zelensky, in his nightly address, noted delays in the delivery of promised weapons cost the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. Danilov says Ukraine will not start any offensive unprepared.
Heavy fighting continues in Sudan despite regional and international calls for a truce. That is the sound of an airstrike that hit close to military headquarters in Khartoum Tuesday morning. And the European Parliament approves ambitious and sweeping climate change policies. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. A top Ukrainian official says it's only a matter of time before his country's military achieves the necessary preparedness to launch its counteroffensive against Russian troops. This as Russian President Vladimir Putin visited command posts of his forces fighting in Ukraine for the second time in 2 months, while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made his latest trip near the front line. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council tells the AP the country's allies are helping Ukraine acquire the necessary equipment to launch the attack, delivering heavy armored vehicles and ammunition. But Alexei Danilov also expressed frustration that allied officials sometimes promise one thing and do a completely different one. While he didn't elaborate, President Volodymyr Zelensky in his nightly address noted delays in the delivery of promised weapons cost the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. Danilov says Ukraine will not start any offensive unprepared, and while stopping short of confirming the Patriot air defense system promised by the U.S. has arrived, he says that Ukraine's current weapon stockpiles will be enough to curb Russia. I'm Ben Thomas.
Thank you, Ben. And the Sudanese capital endured a fourth day of heavy fighting Tuesday, despite promises by both the military and rapid support forces to honor a 24-hour ceasefire. Doctors in Sudan says the fighting has forced several hospitals to shut down, as Michael Atit reports from Khartoum, Sudan. That is the sound of an airstrike that hit close to military headquarters in Khartoum Tuesday morning, as the warring side showed no sign of upholding the ceasefire announced the day before. More fighting raged between the military and the rapid support forces around Khartoum International Airport and the presidential palace. The military remain in control of state television and radio. Meanwhile, the Sudanese Doctors' Union said the death toll has risen to more than 180, with nearly 2,000 others injured. The Sudanese Doctors' Syndicate Steering Committee also reported that 16 hospitals in Khartoum and other cities across the country have been shut down because of damage from the fighting or general insecurity. Several hospitals in Khartoum were evacuated, including Ashab, Ibn Sina, Bashair, Al Turki, Al Zaytuna, Imperial, Ashurta, Bahri, and Dr. Salma Center for Kidney Diseases. Others, such as Fidel, Al Baraha, and Haja Safi, were out of service. Citizens here describe the closure of these health facilities as a humanitarian crime. Speaking to VOA this morning, Haysam Ibrahim, the Secretary General for the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, says their volunteers are having trouble accessing victims of the fighting at the moment. He says the warring parties need to allow some room for humanitarian activities to at least bury the dead bodies before Khartoum becomes an environmentally risky area. He says the health situation is not promising. There are people in the ICU who required immediate oxygen intervention. He says this should be a message to the warring parties to allow passage of medical assistance from the storage areas of the medical supply to the operational hospitals. Another Khartoum resident, Hassan Ibrahim, works as a nurse at Khartoum Teaching Hospital, one of the health facilities forced to shut down. Speaking to VOA from his residence in Abu Adam neighborhoods, Ibrahim says he escaped downtown Monday morning after heavy shelling and random gunshot made it impossible to continue working in the hospital. He says the main Khartoum teaching hospital and the people's hospital have been hit so much. Some health workers there lost their lives and others are injured. He says we also have some students in Khartoum University who have been stranded there for the past 4 days and they don't have anything to eat. Hapsa Azaki, a mother of five, says there has been no electricity or running water since Saturday. She describes to VOA the situation as unpredictable. There is no bread, she says, and we are only consuming what we had stocked for our Ramadan fasting, such as rice, lentils, macaroni, and other foods. She says nearby shops are open, but we cannot access the main market. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement Tuesday that aid efforts in Sudan have been interrupted in many areas due to widespread insecurity. It said there are many reports of humanitarian assets being looted. The World Health Organization warned that several of Khartoum's hospitals have run out of blood, transfusion equipment, intravenous fluids, and other vital medical supplies. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
The White House on Tuesday said there are no plans at this time for a government-sponsored evacuation of Sudan as heavy gunfire persisted in the capital Khartoum despite a truce agreement. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters that American citizens in the country should remain sheltered in place at this time. The European Parliament on Tuesday approved sweeping reforms to make EU climate change policies more ambitious, including an upgrade of the bloc's carbon market that is set to hike the cost of polluting in Europe. Europe's carbon market forces power plants and factories to buy CO2 permits when they pollute. It has slashed those sector emissions by 43% since 2005, but is facing a revamp to hit more ambitious EU climate change targets. Parliament voted to approve, with a large majority, a deal agreed last year by negotiators from EU countries and Parliament to reform the carbon market to cut emissions by 62% from 2005 levels by 2030. EU Parliament President Roberta Metsola.
We can say Europe leads the green revolution and we will be the world's first climate neutral continent. And the deals on the reform of the emissions trading system, the carbon border adjustment mechanism and the social climate fund are all central and complementary in keeping the European Green Deal on track. These laws will put a price on the carbon we produce, and it means that the most polluting industries will have to increase their emission reduction targets. It will also put a price for non-EU producers, providing a level playing field so that we will not leave our industry at a disadvantage vis-à-vis their external competitors. They will also need to pay for their emissions if their products are to be sold in Europe. And with the help of the Social Climate Fund, amounting to an estimated total of €86.7 billion, this will ensure that the climate transition leaves no one behind. We have to make this transition together.
That's EU Parliament President Roberta Metsola. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong has outlined her government's ambition to, quote, avert war and maintain peace, unquote, in the Indo-Pacific region. Wong addressed the National Press Club in Canberra, saying Australia wants to ensure there is a, quote, strategic equilibrium, unquote, in Asia, where, quote, no country dominates and no country is dominated, unquote. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Penny Wong said Monday that Australia didn't want competition between the United States and China to Korea into conflict. Wong warned that China continues to modernize its military at a pace and scale not seen in the world for nearly a century, with little transparency or assurance about its strategic intent. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister also detailed the destabilizing consequences of coercive trade measures, political interference, and the reshaping of international rules. However, there was no specific mention of China in the remarks or of the trade restrictions Beijing has imposed on various Australian export commodities because of diplomatic tensions stretching back to 2017. Wong told the audience in Canberra about her concerns for Taiwan, which China regards as a wayward province that could be retaken by force.
Today, I want to talk to you about how we avert war and maintain peace. And more than that, how we shape a region that reflects our national interests and our shared regional interests. Those interests lie in a region that operates by rules, standards and norms, where a larger country does not determine the fate of a smaller country.
Wong said the Canberra government had to lower the heat on any potential conflict, while increasing pressure on others to do the same.
A war over Taiwan would be catastrophic for all. We know that there would be no real winners, and we know maintaining the status quo is comprehensively superior to any alternative.
There has so far been no reaction in Beijing to Wong's comments. Relations between the two Indo-Pacific nations began to deteriorate in 2017 over growing concerns about alleged Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs. There followed further disagreements about Taiwan, freedom of navigation in the contested South China Sea, and the origins of COVID-19, which was first detected in China. However, Australia's left-leaning government, elected almost a year ago, has made concerted efforts to ease tensions with China, Australia's biggest trading partner. Earlier this month, Canberra agreed to suspend its appeal to the World Trade Organization against China's punitive tariffs on Australian barley, which Beijing has agreed to review. Australian officials have said they were confident that China would scrap the tariffs, raising hope that restrictions on other exports, including wine, would also end. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, the Fox Television News Network and Dominion Voting Systems have reached a $787 million settlement in the voting machine company's defamation lawsuit. The agreement averts a trial in the case that exposed how the top-rated network chased viewers by promoting lies about the 2020 presidential election. Dominion lawyer Justin Nelson said the deal shows that truth matters and lies have consequences. Dominion had asked for $1.6 billion in arguing that Fox had damaged its reputation by helping peddle phony conspiracy theories about its equipment switching votes from former President Donald Trump to winner Democrat Joe Biden. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. With Turkey nearing hotly contested presidential elections in May, international right groups are condemning a crackdown on independent media that have challenged the incumbent president's control of the mainstream media. Doria Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Dokuzeki's news portal, with its nationwide network of reporters, is one of the growing number of independent media platforms covering Turkey's presidential elections in May. In previous polls, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had a tight grip on media coverage, but not anymore, says Gürkan Biçici, editor-in-chief of Dokuzeki's Haber, an online news agency. He says the opposition media or independent media have grown and increased their sphere of influence. I can even say that in terms of the numbers of viewers on election day, the audience and the followers of independent organizations will be much more than mainstream media. Thus, the effort of the government to establish a monopoly failed. They lost. But the government-controlled media regulatory authority is stepping up its fines on independent media stations, prompting condemnation by 20 international media and freedom of expression watchdogs. Turkey representative for the Paris-based Reporters Without Borders.
If there is a duty of regulation, this should be not weaponized against a critical TV station before these crucial elections.
The government denies a charge of partisanship by the regulatory authority. Independent stations like Halk TV say fines have become a part of doing business and warn the real threat is closure ahead of elections next month. Halk TV News Editor-in-Chief Bengusha Baba Eker. She says in our broadcast they always find a reason for a penalty, a sentence, an interview or a statement. And that is why we're always on alert. We're always in expectation. Managers and fellow journalists are responsible for keeping this channel open. we're responsible for preventing a penalty that will close this channel down. Despite the risk of closure and fines, stations like Hulk have drawn large audiences, covering events like February's deadly earthquake, when it reported on government shortcomings, some of which Erdogan acknowledged. Analysts say such coverage has helped build independent media's reputation ahead of elections for fair but critical coverage. Sezin Öner is a columnist at Politikyol News Portal.
We wouldn't be hearing about the incapacity of the government had there not been new voices of the media. They really did good reporting, and good reporting is enough in itself. It doesn't have to be just voicing the narrative of the opposition or giving a voice to opposition politicians. But it's just reflecting what's happening on the ground, and that's really important for the election night as well.
New independent media TV channels have been launched in the run-up to the polls, with many reporters who quit the industry returning to help cover an election that all sides claim is one of the most important in the Turkish Republic's history. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Sweden is still waiting for Turkey to approve its application to join NATO. As an original report, Sweden hopes the upcoming Turkish election scheduled for May 14th could be a turning point.
Sweden and Finland lodged a joint application to join NATO just weeks after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The alliance welcomed Finland earlier this month, but Sweden's application has yet to be approved by NATO members Turkey and Hungary. Ankara has accused Sweden of harbouring groups it considers pro-Kurdish terrorists, which Sweden denies. Since the NATO application, Kurdish groups in Sweden have staged anti-Turkish demonstrations, protesting any deal with what they call a fascist government in Turkey. But Sweden's Prime Minister said he hoped next month's presidential elections in Turkey could mark a turning point. Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said, "Now we're waiting for the Turkish elections. I think everyone realizes that there is a substantial role in this, which is about Turkish domestic politics, and that is fully understandable. That's how it is in most countries." Sweden is set to introduce a new anti-terrorism law, which it hopes will persuade Turkey to approve its NATO application. Turkey has so far given a measured response. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Cavusoglu said earlier this month, "Of course, they have taken some steps, but they are not enough. We are expecting additional efforts in the coming period." NATO hopes that Sweden's application is ratified in time for the alliance's annual summit in July. Former Turkish diplomat Alper Koshkun is from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It will depend more on whether, in the aftermath of the elections, irrespective of who wins, the Turkish authorities will be able to say to themselves and to the public at large that some of Turkey's expectations from Sweden have been met in terms of the implementation of that very law.
Domestic issues trump foreign policy in Turkey's election campaign, and that could benefit Sweden's NATO application, says Koshkun.
Especially now, in the aftermath of the earthquakes and the economic circumstances in Turkey, it has even decreased even more. In that sense, I don't think, as far as the public opinion is concerned, or as far as the interest of the political parties in Turkey is concerned, it's a leading topic that there is attention on. And I think that alleviates the domestic political pressure on the issue, which should facilitate a solution post-election.
Turkish opposition parties have rallied behind a single candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, in an effort to unseat incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. An opposition win could benefit Sweden.
They've made it clear that they will underline Turkey's place within NATO, within the Western security architecture.
Meanwhile, Hungarian lawmakers say they are blocking Sweden's NATO bid over its recent criticism of their country's democratic credentials. Analysts say Turkey's approval of Sweden's bid would likely pressure Hungary to do the same. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including a standoff between President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy over the nation's finances that escalated this week, with the White House blasting the speaker as he turned to the New York Stock Exchange to pitch his debt ceiling plan. We'll examine this story and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chido Lofa in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This past year, the People's Republic of China, or PRC, and Hong Kong authorities have further criminalized dissent, undermining the human rights and fundamental freedoms of people in Hong Kong, according to the recently released Hong Kong Policy Act report. The Hong Kong government has persisted in its enforcement of the national security law and wielded a sedition law to silence perceived critics, with more than 1,200 people reportedly detained for their political beliefs. In the last year, the PRC authorities continued to deny people in Hong Kong the ability to play a meaningful role in the city's governance, including for the first time permitting only one candidate to run for Hong Kong chief executive. Hong Kong authorities continue to use the national security law imposed by Beijing on Hong Kong in June 2020 to further erode the rule of law in Hong Kong and the fundamental freedoms of people in Hong Kong. Hong Kong authorities continue to arrest and prosecute people for peaceful political expression, including for posting and forwarding social media posts. Local authorities criminally charge people engaged in online political speech. Authorities continue to undermine the rights of defendants in cases designated as involving national security, including by denying them bail and subjecting them to lengthy periods of pretrial detention, stripping them of the right to a trial by jury, and requiring that their cases be overseen by a judge designated by the Beijing-endorsed chief executive. Hong Kong and PRC authorities continue to target civil society groups, media companies, activists, journalists, political parties, labor unions, and other individuals and organizations that they accused of being connected to Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement or critical of the government. Authorities arrested then 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen, the former Catholic Bishop of Hong Kong, and others on suspicion of collusion with foreign forces. Hong Kong officials prosecuted editors and executives of now-closed media outlets Apple Daily and Stan News, including Apple Daily founder Jimmy Lai, for alleged national security-related offenses, and accused Stan News of sedition for publishing news articles related to pro-democracy politicians. Independent media outlets continued to close, citing Hong Kong's restrictive political environment. Citing Hong Kong's declining rule of law, Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged PRC authorities to restore protected rights and freedoms to the people of Hong Kong, release those unjustly detained or imprisoned, and respect the rule of law and human rights in Hong Kong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.